An art exhibit opening today in Kansas City tells a story that spans generations and continents, the story of the stigma of HIV. The disease is increasingly treatable, but when people first started noticing it, contracting HIV was absolutely lethal. It was shrouded in total mystery, and all anyone really knew about it was the toll it took on a person's body, which was merciless, and that it seemed to affect the gay community disproportionately. So that left some baggage that has not gone away. It's also something we talk about less and less, which makes it a big deal that Kansas City is one of just a handful of cities worldwide that the artist behind this project visited for his research. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. The artist is with me now, GK Callahan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Gina. Thank you.
I like your initials.
I appreciate it. It's a family name.
What got you interested in exploring HIV in your art to begin with?
Well, it all kind of began with a project called the Please Touch Community Garden, which is a garden I formed in San Francisco, or founded in San Francisco. And during the initial building of the garden, we found over 2,000 hypodermic needles.
Can you tell me what year we're talking about?
2010.
Roughly? Okay.
2011. And after the garden, after we started building the garden and we were having clients come out there, people who were blind and visually impaired or children in grade schools and things like that, I would find 10 to 15 needles a day. And so it became a really big problem. So I'd have to go and sweep the garden for needles before we opened every day. And so I started working with the city of San Francisco and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation to get 24-hour Sharps container boxes put up so that IV drug users had a place to put their needles besides in the garden. And when I started working with the AIDS Foundation, I found out that the needles were basically this aftermath of combating the HIV disease.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So in San Francisco started the needle exchange program in our country. And it was trying to reduce the spread of HIV by having people not share needles. So there wasn't blood-to-blood sharing. San Francisco, they hand out about 2.4 million needles a year, and they only collect about a million back, at least back when I was living there. That stat could have changed. It's not up to date. And so when I started seeing all these needles, it was almost like seeing this boogie monster that I've always lived with and known about and a sort of real form, you know.
Can I ask, how old are you?
I am 35.
So as a 35-year-old, the idea that for you, HIV was a boogeyman is really interesting to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it goes back to my mother, and she's probably listening. So hi, Mom. When I was growing up, she used to sell HIV and AIDS drugs. And so, and a lot of her friends were gay or queer. And so it was a very common topic around our house, using protection and condoms and these sort of things. And even as a young child, we would go to AIDS walks and, you know, support, you know, to finding a cure and, you know, getting people healthy. And it was just something that our family did a lot of. You know,
like
I came to the generation where I saw Rent on Broadway and, you know, its original cast and things like that. So, yeah. And being a gay male myself, it's something that you constantly are in fear of or thinking about, especially when living in San Francisco, even in the early 2000s. I mean, I got tested every 3 months, you know, something that I was constantly worried that, you know, was going to happen.
The project that you're sharing with the public starting this weekend at the Leedy Volkus Art Center is called Contracting an Issue. And you did visit a handful of locations for that: Kansas City, Tampa, San Francisco, and Tanzania. Do I have that right?
You have that correct, yes.
Can you explain the vision for this project and what these four locations represent?
Well, let me see, how would I answer that? The vision for the project was always to create an awareness around the stigma. Right. And so to tell people's stories, because I thought stories help change people's lives. Right. Stories can be very impactful. And so I wanted to tell these stories, but I also wanted to keep anonymity. And that's why we hired the actors. Right. And so I would collect these stories.
Explain that. So you hired the idea is that you hired actors to go into, it seems like, crowded spaces.
Right. Yeah. Public spaces. So community centers, gardens, out in the street, on the sidewalk, where shopping centers, and they would portray these interviews that I did. It was almost like a verbatim theater. So I would spend several months, if not most of a year, interviewing people.
In that city,
that location. Yeah, because I had a feeling that the attitude around it was different in different parts of the country and different parts of the world, right? And so in San Francisco, the first one I did, the play actually, or the performance ended up being called Always Waiting, because I think people were so surrounded with the issue of HIV that they felt like they, especially as gay men, that they were just waiting for it to happen.
Those were a lot of waiting room images.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And go on. In the other locations?
The locations. So I got the opportunity after I finished grad school to move to Kansas City. My parents are here. And I really wanted to know what the Midwest thought about this. You know, a lot of these conversations come out of New York or out of San Francisco, and so the Midwest is often ignored, and I think it was really pertinent to hear what people here, you know, wanted to say, you know, how it was affecting their lives, you know, what were the issues going on here? Because our country's large. It's not just the East and West Coast.
I've noticed that. So when you came here and you started talking to people and you were getting that perspective of what are people saying in the Midwest, did anything surprise you?
Not surprised. I know the first thing that comes to mind is that Kansas City nice. That idea that it was, you know, people said they wanted to do something or talk about a topic, but they didn't really want to have that conversation. And so they were just being polite, right? And then, you know, I would like schedule an interview and then they wouldn't show up, right? Because they were like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. That sounds wonderful. And then.
So nice they couldn't even say no to you.
Right. And so that was one of the things that I found different.
I understand that you've become interested in what you call the criminalization of HIV and that has particular relevance to Kansas City.
Yeah, it does, especially right now. Criminalization of HIV is very real. There are 34 states out there that still criminalize not disclosing your status and a number of other things within the law. I'm not a lawyer, so. But yeah, when doing this project, I got introduced to the HIV, Missouri HIV Justice Coalition, and they're actively trying to change the laws here in Missouri. In Missouri, you could have incarceration for up to 30 years for not disclosing your status. And we have some of the most high profile cases in the nation have happened here in Missouri. And so it became really apparent to me that this is an issue that it's really at the forefront of HIV today.
Can you explain a little bit? I mean, what is the law exactly? What is it that people are expected to do? Who are they expected to notify?
I don't have the law in front of me. It's complicated, so I don't want to explain something that I don't have enough knowledge on. But I will tell you that two things. One, you can go to empowermissouri.org and find out more information. That's where the HIV Justice Coalition is housed. You can also go to their Facebook page. But the law, what's wrong, or I don't know about the right words, wrong. What needs to be changed with the law is that it's not modern. It's out of date. It was put into place when we didn't know so much about HIV, and now we know so much more. And so it doesn't take into account like condom use or being on antiviral drugs as a way to not put your partner in risk. And so it doesn't even include those sort of things. It has weird things in it like the throwing of breast milk or something like that, when HIV doesn't travel in breast milk or saliva. And so the laws just needs to be modernized. It's just not up to date with our science.
Which brings me back to your age. In a way, I wonder, being fairly young, if you do think that in some way that shapes the way you think and feel about the information as you're hearing it from all of the different people you're talking about, from all these different backgrounds, in all these different places within the U.S. and even on another continent in Africa. When I was a kid, the AIDS epidemic was front and center in the news. People were just beginning to understand what it was. I remember that really clearly, but I didn't live through losing friends in the way that I think someone even just 10 years older than me would have. It was something I experienced entirely through fear expressed in the media and educational messaging, which was probably vaguely misguided because we're talking about the late 80s and early 90s. When you're talking about that the language in this law comes from a time that's out of date, it's probably a time that you don't remember, right? And I'm interested in the stigma that you're talking about is a holdover from those days, right?
Well, it is a holdover from those days, correct. But what I always fascinates me is how little people do not know about HIV/AIDS today. And people are very misinformed. And so I don't think age matters. I know people who are my parents' age or older, and they're still either even more misinformed than some of the younger generations. I know gay men that are younger than me that are also misinformed. I mean, there's just been a lot of movement and a lot of advancements medically over the last 40 years. And I don't think your age has anything to do with that. I think it's factual information, and people just need to learn.
Blair Schulman is with us now. He's the curator of this exhibit called Mapping Stigma, which shows some of G.K. Callahan's work on this issue. And Blair, Tell me how you came to be part of this project and what you've heard in GK's stories as he's been working on all of this.
Thank you, Gina. GK and I have mutual friends, and that's how we came to know one another. And when he came to Kansas City to discuss contracting an issue, and I was very interested in hearing him talk about it because HIV as part of the public discourse had diminished, which is good in some respects because that means the medical advancement is helping the public consciousness. But because of its status as a manageable condition, but the stigmatization still lingered. I mean, hence the need for GK to have to put the dialogue to actors to discuss it.
Wait, can you talk about that a little bit more? That seems really significant.
Well, GK interviewed a lot of people in all these cities, and the fact that everybody wanted to remain anonymous, I mean, GK assured anonymity by letting everybody know from the outset that he was going to give the dialogue to a third party, these actors, and have them perform their dialogue verbatim so that the word could get out in truth, but everybody who is discussing it would retain their anonymity, which has a lot to do with the idea that HIV stigmatization is the remnant of this condition that still lingers after 40-odd years of it being part of the public consciousness.
Yeah, that you're not a person who has contracted an illness, a viral infection, that you are a person who's carrying something larger than that.
That's right.
You know, the photos of Kansas City intrigue me, and I wonder what thoughts you have about those. There's the actor who is delivering the lines, is standing on the street in the middle of big crowds, mm-hmm. talking about supposedly his experience with HIV, although these are other people's experiences he's talking about. When you see the images of the crowds and how they're looking at him, as a person who lives in Kansas City and has been active in the Crossroads where a lot of these photos take place, how do the photos make you feel?
Well, it's kind of funny to see that because it goes back to what GK said about the Kansas City Nice, that everybody's being very polite about it, and you can tell that they're curious and they're interested, but they're a little bit afraid to get involved.
It's like there's a force field around the person. There's a certain distance everyone's keeping, and almost like...
That's the problem with HIV, is that people still look at it as, oh, no, not me. I don't want to get involved in this. It still has this... It has stigmatization. It really makes people feel not good about themselves.
Blair, do you feel like... You're coming to this as someone who moved to Kansas City from New York. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's interesting that you're from New York, you're a curator, but you also bring your own personal experience, your own community
right.
experience, and that GK is bringing his experience largely from San Francisco. Is that important here?
I think so. I do want to say that Kansas City has a very strong activist community. So things that were taking place in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York were... taking place with equal measure in Kansas City as well. Like I said, they do have a strong activist community. But I am older than GK, and I do remember the HIV and AIDS as something that was an untouchable condition that was not discussed in polite company. And I do remember the Reagan administration refusing to even utter the word. And it took people like Larry Kramer, the playwright, who became a public advocate and a LGBT rights activist, to help change public policy. He was one of the first people to change public health policy. And also to that, Elizabeth Taylor, of all people, really brought it to – made HIV-AIDS discussion – gave it a public face that made it okay for people to talk about it. She started the AIDS Foundation in 1991, I think. And it was her that, with her friendship with Nancy Reagan, of all people, forced Ronald Reagan to actually utter the word AIDS at like 7 or 8 years into this catastrophe. And even though someone like Larry Kramer from New York was starting GMHC, the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and ACT UP and Project Achieve and things like that, it took someone like a legitimate movie star like Elizabeth Taylor to bring it into the public consciousness.
And do you think perhaps that she was a woman was important to that?
I think she was a person who was socially untouchable. She was beloved by generations, people of all ages, whatever your age, whatever your gender, or
whatever checkboxes,
whatever checkboxes, she put a public face on it. I mean, she has a great quote. You know, bad enough that people are dying of AIDS, they shouldn't have to die of ignorance too. So that's pretty darn strong language to say at that time.
As you listen to someone much younger than yourself reflecting on that, now ignorance is coming from not talking about it, even though so much has been learned. Like, ignorance at early on was stemming from that, really, for a long time, nothing was known.
That's
and
right.
Then for a long time, nothing was uttered because of stigma. And now it seems like maybe the problem is that a false sense of security or...
Well, that's a legitimate response. I do think because HIV is now a manageable condition and you can get tested easily and regularly, and you do, there is more medicines and other things that can help your condition. But of course, there is a problem with access and affordability, which still presents it as an enormous problem. But the air of legitimacy about it still lingers. I'm old enough to remember when they used to call AIDS GRID. And when I was in school, people were making GRID jokes, which
what is GRID? I'm not aware of that.
It was originally called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, because when the first reports came out in 1981 in the Times, it was mostly focused on gay men in New York and LA and San Francisco. So for a long time, that's why AIDS was attached as a quote-unquote gay disease. And it only took It took several years for people like Anthony Fauci and Matilda Krim, people who were at the forefront of public health policy, to illuminate the fact that, no, this was just not a gay disease. It was a disease that it was a condition that everyone was affected by.
So when you first heard what GK was doing, I understand that the two of you would just like talk about, you know, as people traveling in the arts community in Kansas City, people with similar interests, that you were hearing about this project as a friend.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about what you were hearing?
Well, it was interesting, and I think it may have been that because we are a little older than some of our friends, that we were talking about it in terms of life experience, that we did know people who were affected by HIV/AIDS. I think less so than people older than myself. I say in my statement that I'm a person of a certain age. My direct social circle was not so much affected. We weren't losing people, but you did see what occurred in the generation before us. And that really formed my adulthood. And I think similarly to GK, and it was this shared experience that kind of brought us together and helped us to form the idea of, let's bring this to the public front and put this together in an exhibition.
So, GK, when you talk to people in Kansas City specifically, is there a line that someone said that ended up being delivered by this actor in the scenes that people will see in these photographs that really, like, reverberates in your mind that you'd like to talk about? Or a story that someone told? It doesn't have to be the line, per se.
Well, I don't know if I have a particular story that I can share or that I think it's appropriate to share. But when doing these interviews, some of the stories were quite difficult about people knowing their status and not telling people about, you know, how they were treated by their friends or their family and disowned. And, you know, some of the stories were hard to carry a little bit, and not just in Kansas City, but in general. But yeah, so I don't know if I have a specific story in mind.
The Tanzania piece of this is interesting to me. Can you tell me what brought you there and what that revealed to you?
Yeah, so I went there for multiple reasons. One, my good friends of mine got married and they were going to go build a school over there, and they invited me to come on the trip. And I'd always thought about Africa. It's one of the largest epicenters of the HIV outbreak. And so it's always been on my mind. What was interesting to me was their relationship. You know, in America, I think for the most part, HIV/AIDS is viewed as a gay issue. And in Africa, it's not, right? Queerness and homophobia are still very stunted there, right? I mean, there's not, I didn't say that quite correctly, but Yeah, they're very homophobic there, right? And so gay doesn't really exist. And so a lot of the women take the brunt of the blame, at least where I was in Tanzania. And so I was interested in learning and seeing what that was like and, you know, understanding what it was like culturally in a very different land.
Do I understand right that you also had some realizations about the relationship between anonymity and HIV and how people view all of that?
I don't quite understand. I'm sorry.
That the role of disclosure and anonymity is different, or no, that's not correct.
No, I don't think that's correct. I mean, when the whole trip was really about permission, right? It was about meeting these women and asking if it was okay if I interact with them. You know, we had conversations through translators about, you know, displacement, employment, you know, what they were doing with their lives, how they were treated. Over there, the women that I interacted with, the stigma was extremely high. People didn't want to share toilets or housing or dishes with them. And so it was something that we experienced here almost 40 years ago, right? And so it was really interesting to get to go over there. But the initial trip was basically this sort of field work to see if it was okay to work with them. I didn't want to go in and expect that I was just accepted, right? I had to go in and, you know, kind of introduce myself and make friends and start from there.
Blair, what do you hope that people here take away from tonight's opening at Lady Vulcas when they see the art you've chosen to display and the way you've chosen to present it?
I want people to walk away and understand that the idea that HIV/AIDS, although medical breakthroughs have really helped to make this a manageable condition, the ideas of stigmatization, which I think is the biggest public health policy issue, are still lingering and they're still very present. To have people in 2018, 2019 still be unable to come out to their family with something that is not killing them, whereas 40 years ago it would have. And there are plenty of stories about how families turn their back on people who are dying. And thank goodness that has diminished in some most capacity. But I want people to be aware that stigmatization is a really big deal. And I want people to become more accepting of the idea that don't be afraid of one another and just talk about it.
Blair Schulman, GK Callahan, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
The exhibit is Mapping Stigma with Art by GK Callahan, curated by Blair Schulman. Up next, big plans for a new documentary about a local civil rights leader who was assassinated. Why don't we hear that story more? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. This year's Rocket Grant recipients were announced earlier this week. Those are grants for art projects of all kinds, with support coming from the Charlotte Street Foundation in Kansas City, the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence, and the Andy Warhol Foundation in New York. The whole list of award winners has us excited for the coming year. But we wanted to bring in one grant recipient in particular to talk about what he's working on. Emil Cleaver is making a documentary about a guy named Leon Jordan, a Kansas City civil rights leader who was assassinated before his work was done. And Emil, for those who don't know, who was Leon Jordan?
Well, Leon Jordan was one of the first African-American police officers in Kansas City. He rose to the ranks of lieutenant. Then he moved to Liberia and became the head of the National Police Force. And when he came back to Kansas City, he formed Freedom Incorporated, which became one of the most powerful political organizations in the state. He became a state representative, and I think during his third term, while he was running for his third term, he was assassinated in front of his nightclub, the Green Duck.
You are the son of Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. He was the first black mayor of Kansas City and a longtime minister of a church here in town. Do you think that the perspective you bring as Emanuel Cleaver's son might shape the way you understand Leon Jordan's story?
I would say probably it does. I mean, because I grew up around Freedom Incorporated as a youngster.
Can you explain what that is for people who don't know?
Freedom Incorporated. Mm-hmm. Okay. Freedom Incorporated is a black political organization started in 1961. Leon Jordan, Bruce R. Watkins, five others helped found this organization. Because during that time, the black community didn't really have a say on who their political leaders were. At that time, the mafia, organized crime, kind of controlled a lot of the political candidates, and they kind of handpicked who they wanted to run each district. And so Freedom Incorporated got together and kind of changed that. And it became dangerous because, of course, no one wants to give up power. But Freedom Incorporated chose their own candidates who had the African-American community in their best interest.
And so you grew up around the activities of Freedom Incorporated.
Yes, I grew up around Freedom Incorporated, working on many political candidate campaigns, handing out flyers, going door to door. So, I mean, I've met a lot of the people who knew Leon Jordan. So that may give me a little bit of a different perspective.
Do you, when did you first start thinking that this is a person I'd like to learn more about and tell the story of in a documentary?
Well, when I did a documentary on Freedom Incorporated back in 2012, and so that kind of sparked my interest in Leon Jordan. I learned a little bit about him then, but I always wanted to do something more on him, but kind of just put it in the back burners. But this grant actually sparked my interest back up and got the wheels rolling again.
There's been a push in recent years to reopen his case. It's been an unsolved murder case in Kansas City for decades. What are your thoughts about that? Because that sort of, as far as people hearing the name Leon Jordan in recent years, that's a lot of why they might have learned about this guy.
Right. Well, I think the case may have been closed, actually. The case is believed to be solved at this point. It did go unsolved for 40 years. There were different suspects, different theories on what happened. But Alvin Sykes kind of pushed the police department to open the case back up. And then there were two Kansas City Star writers who kind of put the pieces together and figured out who murdered Leon Jordan.
What role does that recent drama around all of this add to your understanding of it? I mean, were you just like eyes peeled to the paper?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think I've tried to read every article that was written about it, but I mean, it's the drama in it is enough for a film, a feature film or a TV movie. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. The life that he had and some of the theories even of why he was murdered.
What are some of those theories?
Well, there were some theories, I guess, he was involved in, there was a member of the Black Mafia who, I guess he crossed or, at one point he had, kind of helped him, get out of jail a few times. And once he started dealing drugs, Leon Jordan didn't want to have anything to do with them. So there was maybe a theory that he was killed because of that. He had hit a state representative, a white state representative. I think knocked him out,
He
physically hit a representative in the 1960s.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'm not sure exactly the reason, but it was in the House, and there was a disagreement. This representative was associated with the mafia, and Leon Jordan, I think, had a temper, and the guy said something he didn't like, and Leon Jordan hit him, knocked him down. So there were theories that there was retaliation for that, and a few others. I mean, as I do research and do some of the interviews, I hope to learn even more.
Yeah, of course his assassination isn't the only piece of his story. That's the last scene in his life.
Right.
When you think about the work that he did throughout a lifetime, is there something that stands out that you are really hoping that more of Kansas City will know about?
Well, I think the importance of Freedom Incorporated, because I think a lot of young people grow up today and see Mayor Sly James, Barack Obama. But there was a time when black leaders couldn't get elected in Kansas City, especially. And Leon Jordan, Freedom Incorporated, kind of opened that door for Bruce Watkins to get on the city council, Emmanuel Cleaver to become the first black mayor, Alan Wheat to become a United States congressman. So, I mean, it kind of opened those doors. Also, public accommodations, you know, that law was passed here in Kansas City before anywhere else in the country. And a big part of that was because of Freedom Incorporated.
There's a statue of Leon Jordan over on Benton Boulevard in what's actually called the Leon M. Jordan Memorial Park.
Yes.
It's like there is something honoring him in Kansas City, but it's almost a well-kept secret. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, and that's why I wanted to do this documentary. I mean, it's great that there's a statue and there's a park named in his honor. There's also a police station named in his honor. But I just felt like as a filmmaker, bringing his story to the screen was something that would bring his story to a wider audience.
Is there someone who you are planning on talking to as you work on this documentary whose stories you are just really excited to hear? Someone who had a relationship with Leon Jordan that you know, like, there's just a wealth of information here and you're just psyched to be ready to go get it?
Yeah, there are a few people that I would like to interview. Maybe Mr. Brooks, Alvin Brooks. He would be a great person to interview. Alvin Sykes, I'm not sure if he knew Leon Jordan, but he...
Clearly passionate about the case.
Right. I would like to interview the Star reporters who broke the story.
Are you going to interview your dad?
I might interview him. I may interview him. I did an interview for the Freedom Incorporated documentary where he talked about Leon Jordan, and I didn't use it in that documentary, so I may put it in this film.
What are you personally hoping to learn or understand better? Like the really underlying questions that are driving you as you pursue this project, this documentary, short documentary on Leon Jordan?
Well, one of the big ones is why he was murdered. And I don't know if I'll find the answer to that, but I wanted to know why exactly he was murdered. I know he was involved in a lot of things and had a lot of friends and a lot of enemies, but want to know about that. And I kind of want to learn more about his time over in Liberia.
Well, Emile Cleaver, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Emile's movie, A Legacy of Leadership, will be about the life and assassination of Leon Mercer Jordan. Up next, a little music to start your weekend right on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to hear a little snippet of music from a new album. It's by a string duo here in town called The Wires, and it's lovely. Check this out. The song is called Prairie Fire, and don't let this part fool you. It's a build-up. There's some anticipation here. The sound's about to get a lot bigger, so wait for it. But I almost find it hard to believe that this is only two instruments. I'm Gina Kaufman, and the two women playing those instruments are with me now. Laurel Morgan Parks is the violinist, and the cellist is Sasha Groshong. Hi, both of you.
Hi.
So, talk to me a little bit about what it is we're hearing. Because like I said, to me, this sounds like much more than two people.
Yeah. A lot of times we try to play two strings at one time. Before we...
Like each of you are playing two strings at one time.
Yeah. Yeah. Double stops is what that is called. Before we were the Wires, we would play a lot of music that we thought was just kind of thin for two, and we thought, well, we could do much more than this. Let's try to write our own stuff. So yeah, a lot of people tell us it sounds like there's more than just two people playing.
And it's also very percussive.
Yeah, I think we try to keep the rhythm going, and we use a lot of extended techniques. I'm not sure how much is in this specific example, to keep it interesting and the percussive aspect going.
Okay, so a lot of people, if they wanted to make a sound that sounds bigger than what just two instrumentalists can create with the two of them, a lot of people would add musicians. That was not your approach. It seems like the two of you as a duo have a history and one that matters to you, that you are a collaborative team and that your friendship is a big part of it. So I'd like you to walk me now through the story of how you two became collaborators. And I'll start with you, Sasha.
Well, Laurel and I met at UMKC, and we had a bunch of mutual friends. I actually, when I first met her, I didn't know if I could trust her, but she's become...
What?
I think we talked, I talked to a mutual friend of ours, and I was like, can you trust that Laurel? And now she's one of my most...
But why why didn't you think you could trust her?
Oh, she just had a mysterious vibe about her. Mm-hmm. But now she's become one of my...
You agree with this.
Well, I thought you were too cool for school, so there you go.
And you were kind of right that she was like, not sure.
Yeah.
You were being auditioned from afar.
Right, exactly.
Not really auditioned, just, you know, we're checking up on each other. Anyway.
But then I needed a ride, and you had a car. And ever since then, we are friends.
Yes, and we ended up living behind one another and playing a bunch of gigs together. And I moved away for a while, and we just continued our friendship.
I want to back up and say... So you're both at UMKC in the conservatory, and you know of each other, are wary of each other, but then there's this magical car ride where everything changes. I need to know more about this. Did you just need to be in a car together for a few minutes to, like, get past whatever skepticism you had?
No, I think we both liked each other. And I think on that first car ride, I got into the car. We got to work. We both worked at a music store up north. And it was time to go into work. And I told Laurel, I'm not going in there. I'm not going in there to teach. I'm just not.
And I was so shocked that you would just quit your job right then and there. But now I realize you always say that. And it's fine. Pretty much before we do anything, she's like, I'm not doing it. And I'm like, okay, neither am I. And then we do it and it's fine.
So you didn't really quit your job.
No, no.
All right. So tell me about your first experiences collaborating together, because I want to know where the sound that I was just hearing came from. It sounds to me both very poppy in a way that two strings alone seems like that would be hard to pull off. But it also sounds like I hear the classical influence in it.
Yeah, I don't know where it really comes from. I know that we just try to write music that's interesting to us. And it just sometimes takes months to get it right. So this album took like 7 years of just many rehearsals and working out parts and making sure that we both like it and that it's true to ourselves. And yeah, I don't know.
I think... Two, we write everything together, so everything's really time-consuming. There were some other aspects. I had some babies and things in there in the last 7 years, but since we write everything together, it is really fun, but also very slow.
The fact that you write everything together seems like it's maybe part of that the idea would not be to add more people to make a sound bigger, because you have a sound that is about the two of you almost as a character. And the reason I think that's interesting is because when you think about friendships, if I think about, if I'm thinking about a good friend of mine right now whose people have said that when the two of us are together, it's like that's a third person. The two of us together is its own person. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And musically, that's what I'm hearing from you, that your sound is the two of you.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Like when we're together, there's like this extra part of my personality that comes out and is like, it feels like a shared energy. And yeah, I would say we work really well together because we're both really honest and we're not offended if the other person is like, okay, that part really sucked that you just came up with. It's like, oh, okay, that's fine. Come up with something better. Let's see if you can do it. Then we just laugh. You know, most of it is just laughing and
drinking wine
and then trying to play and then just, I don't know. It's hysterical. It's really fun.
I do think, too, we have usually a shared vision that we end up for each piece. And I think that helps kind of cultivate our sound for each piece because we usually have a shared imagery that it involves nature.
Tell me, so the song we heard at the very beginning of this conversation, Prairie Fire, tell me about that. I can guess at what would inspire a song called Prairie Fire, but can you tell me the story of your shared vision for that sound and how you used sound to evoke this phenomenon in nature?
So for this one, it's just, I don't know if there's really a story. It's more like we just get this image of like this all-consuming fire that's coming. And as we're playing and as the song builds, like the beginning, you just kind of see it in the distance. And then it just like takes over. And so that's just kind of the visual description of the song. So, it doesn't come from like we weren't in prairie fires or have much experience with fires, except for in your backyard. Oh, yeah, burning the instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. I feel that there's a story I'd like to hear.
Oh, well, one of my favorite things to do is have bonfires. So I had them all growing up. And my family would just get together and talk and drink wine and experience the fire together. And so I love to do that. And since Laurel and I used to live in the backyard, we'd often have bonfires. And sometimes we
would burn instruments because I was teaching a lot of little tiny children at the time, and they would often just drop their violins and completely destroy them. So we'd just bring them over.
Dead instrument parts, you know, with no strings or whatever. It's very cathartic.
And there's no way they could be fixed, and we'd just be like, drop them in the fire and
watch them burn.
Yeah, it was very dramatic.
And not sentimental.
Not really sentimental because we knew, I don't know, they looked, there's something sad about them when, burn them.
But it's also kind of good because, you know, you grow up and you play classical music and you have, you know, all of these expectations and criticisms from others and criticisms from yourself. And something is really cool about letting all of that go, you know, just by burning, you know, you're not supposed to burn a violin, but something about that is so good. You're watching it turn to ashes.
Yeah, there's a spiritual dynamic to it. But we've done this like a lot.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that relationship to classical music growing up? Just what that's like? It sounds like you've been aspiring to be a classical musician for a long time.
Well, I play a lot of classical music now. I have a string quartet called Opus 76, and we do traditional classical music. I also play with New Ear. We're playing a concert tonight at the Bower. And we do all living composers. I play in a little symphony, and I do a lot of other types of music, too. But I think because I've been fortunate enough to play different types of music, you know, classical music is beautiful and wonderful, but there is so much expectation around it.
Can you describe that?
Well, I think sometimes I joke that instead of having a degree in music, I have a degree in criticism because it's all about, you know, finding where you can do better in classical music always. And a lot of folk styles of music is not
almost like there's this the thing exists. There's just a standard for it.
that you're
yeah, you're always searching for perfection, and as humans, we cannot be perfect. It's just never going to happen. But in folk music, it's not let's aspire to be perfect. It's let's where are you now, and join the party. You can come play music with us no matter where you are. And there's something freeing and beautiful about that. And so I think melding those two ideas has actually really helped me to loosen up in all of my types of playing. You know, I'm way less anxious about being perfect in classical music, which is never going to happen anyway.
And yet it will continue to be the goal.
That's the aspiration.
Coral, what is your relationship with the
classical?
Yeah.
Well, I grew up doing Suzuki violin, as many people do. But then when I was 12 or 13, I joined my Pentecostal church band. And they just gave me words with letters on top of, or, you know, the lyrics with like a letter, like for a chord, A or D. And I had no idea what that meant. And so I just kind of figured out that if you got to a certain word, then if I played an A, that would work really well with the song. And so I did that for years because I was so scared of playing in front of people. And then eventually I got really bored and started to just make up my own part. After that, I ended up going to music school. That's where I met Sasha and doing classical music. And I was like, I am kind of horrible in this environment. And
horrible in what way?
Just like, I could never, you know, I was never like as, I felt like I was never as good as everybody else. And that feeling just like, I felt very bad in that environment. And then when I started playing with a band back in the early 2000s and just writing my own music again, I was like, this is where I need to be. And then we started playing music. And I just love that. I write music in a band called Of Tree as well. And so that's just where my passion is. And so I...
To create your own thing.
Yeah. And I, you know, I did
and
a lot of...
to do it with a small group of people, possibly friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I shudder to think what would have happened if you didn't need a ride that day.
I think we would have found each other.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah.
As you think about this new album that you have coming out, Wilder... What do you think it represents in your trajectory as both friends and collaborators and musicians?
It's an evolvement from our first album was more formulaic. Like we're going to write a tango song or we're going to write a jazz song. You know, we were like trying out different styles. And this one was more organic and we weren't trying to create a certain style. So I feel like we're evolving just to... being a little bit more creative, and we also trust ourselves a lot more in our process. It's not so like, is this good? Are we able to do this? It's a little bit more organic, I think.
And I think our writing style is a little bit different. I mean, with our first record, it was a lot of, okay, Laurel's going to play a melody and I'm going to play an accompaniment and then we might switch for a minute or whatever. But this is much more integrated. You know, I think we weave our parts in and out together a lot more, and it creates a lot more interesting
textures. It's a sound.
Yeah, it's a sound together.
Can you tell me a little bit about your performances? You have a show coming up at the Record Bar on May 18th, and I'm curious, you know, I don't picture two people sitting in chairs necessarily like orchestra musicians, but maybe.
No, we will talk in between the songs. We will have the visual projection of each song going on behind us as we play. We have a few surprises planned. So that's 7 to 8:30-ish at the Record Bar on May 18th.
Well, our time is up. Laurel Morgan Parks, violinist, Sasha Groshong, cellist, known as The Wires. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you. Their new album, Wilder, comes out this month. That's a wrap. You can listen back to anything from this week on KCUR's Central Standard at
kcur.org/centralstandard. I recommend catching our discussion about childcare deserts if you didn't hear it already, and our chat with a construction worker poet from Kansas City who's becoming a national celebrity. kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also talk to us on Twitter every time. We love chatting with you at @KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.